Yahweh, after announcing his title as God, shared with Moses the following words. Speaking now in first person, he says, speak, Dabar, be a guide. Communicate to the sons, the children, Bini, of Yisrael, individuals who persist and persevere with God. Saying, Amar, conveying these thoughts through verbal or written communication. In the seventh month, it's based on Shabbat. It's a word that is synonymous with Shabbat, the seventh day, and with the Hebrew word for promise or vow. Kodesh month is based on the Kadosh, the Hebrew verb meaning to renew. So in the seventh month, the month of the Shabbat, the month of the promise, the time of renewal, on the first Ichad of the renewed moon, the Kodesh, there exists for you all a Shabbaton, a special set-apart day to rest and reflect on God's promises. The memorial sign and mental reminder of an inheritance right, a zakaron, called teruah, meaning to sound a warning and shout for joy, announcing a healing gateway, a cleansing and set apart kodesh, invitation to be called out and to meet a mikra. Hello, Kirk. That sounds fairly clear to me.
It does. And in fact, it's amazing. I wrote that all out to talk to you about it.
Oh, okay.
So I'm reading along with you as you were just doing it.
Okay. We're reading from the same source. That was from Kara, which is the third book of the Torah. It means to call out, to invite, to welcome, to read and recite is the name of the book. It's been corrupted to Leviticus. 23rd chapter, 24th statement.
Fourth verse.
Yeah.
It was funny. Now, a couple of things that occurred to me was that it says in the seventh month, and of course, all the Yehudim of today are calling Rosh Hashanah a new year.
Right.
And they're about the only people I know that years in two years at the same time, or two calendars at the same time, but it says the seventh month, so Yahweh knows it ain't the Happy New Year.
Yeah, what you're talking about here, Kirk, is, by the way, a little bit of background. We talked about this yesterday, so it should not be a surprise. While I think there are some who will begin to celebrate Teruah tomorrow at sunset, if you're one who bases your timing on the technical renewing of light on the moon, based on the astronomical calculations, it will begin tonight at sunset. If you're purely observational and actually have to see a renewing sliver on light on the moon to begin your celebration, then you'd begin it tomorrow night. And that the first day is a Shabbaton, a day to rest and reflect on Yahweh's promises. But what you're referring to is Jews, Yehudim, Israelites, while they were in captivity in Babylon, accepted a number of bad habits, and one of them was the Babylonian calendar, which begins this month, and that's why they have Rosh Hashanah, which means head of the year or start of the year. It's Rosh in Hebrew means beginning, like Rashith happens to be the first book of the Torah in the beginning. Shana is a year in Hebrew. It's a word that's based upon the solar, the nature of the solar year. And so when Yahweh is saying this is the seventh month, and they're claiming it's the first month in Rabbinic Judaism, mm-hmm. One of the two of them is wrong.
Sure.
So why would you create a religious holiday at the start of the year that is not only Babylonian in its origin, the thing that God speaks against throughout the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, but is that you are pretending to be Torah observant and you're ignoring the Torah's instructions and replacing it with a Babylonian fraud. Why would you do that? I mean, who in the right mind would do that?
Only somebody trying to twist it around for their own uses. I mean, and then getting everybody to follow along. Remember, they were slaves, so they didn't read and write, most of them. So after a generation or two, you could easily trick these people into whatever, I guess, you wanted to do. But at some point when you read it, it's too clear not to say, hey, we've been had.
Oh, of course. Yeah, and plus they had prophets that were speaking to them. They understood Hebrew. They could listen to the prophets at this time. This was a time when Yahweh deployed many prophets. Mm-hmm. And they were speaking to the people and telling them, you know, you're being played for fools. And he was telling them before they left for Babylon, and he told them after they came back from Babylon.
A little bit while they're there.
Yeah, and even a prophet while they were there in Babylon. But this is also a problem for Christianity. Mm-hmm. Christianity begins its new year in keeping with the Roman calendar. The month of Janus was the beginning of the Roman New Year. Janus was the god of doorways and of new beginnings in Rome. And so with Christians, your new year is no better than the rabbinic Judaism's new year with Rosh Hashanah.
Oh. And if you lived here and you're Jewish, you have 3 years to have to deal with. You have the religious year, you have the American January, and
he's a pope, so it's a Roman Catholic. The mm-hmm. calendar that we use in the West is the Roman Catholic calendar.
Now, is there anything in the verbs when you translate those things, those type of verses, that would indicate that this is a one-time event? Or this is a temporary event?
In fact, as a matter of fact, Hebrew verbs are not constrained in time. So what God said here when he speaks of this being a Shabbaton, this being a memorial sign and a reminder, they're written so that the verbs are always true. They never cease to be relevant. So no, and he's says for you all.
Yes.
Now you all would include all of the children of Yisrael, and you might say, well, I'm not a child of Yisrael. Why does it appeal to me? Well, why don't you think about what Yisrael means?
Means, right?
You know, Ish is the Hebrew word for individuals. So are you an individual?
I am an individual.
Yeah, Sarah is the middle of Yisrael. And Sarah is the mother of the covenant, and her name means to engage and to endure.
Strive.
And El is with God. So if you're an individual who wishes to engage and endure with God, you are Yisrael. If not, then this doesn't apply to you.
Yeah. So there goes that argument.
Yeah, there goes that argument. There's two reminders here that Teruah is about the celebration of seven, the first day of the seventh month, and it exists as a Shabbaton. Mm-hmm. So there's two emphases is here that it's about seven. Is there anything special about seven and Yahweh's plan?
Well, it's a promise. It tells us all the things we need to know as far as figuring out these promises, and we can dig deeper and always use seven. For the mikros, the seven mikros, for instance. And,
yeah, it's God's formula, right? It's 6 + 1 equals perfection. Six being the number of man created on the sixth day, plus God, who is one, equals God's idea of perfection, us being together. You know, how many of these mikra are there?
There are seven.
There are seven of them. Six steps lead to the ultimate destination where we're camping out with God. Mm-hmm. And so this is the fifth of seven. And it's a celebration of seven. But, you know, it's not the only celebration of seven.
No.
The previous Mikra is called the Shabuah.
Mm-hmm.
It's based on seven, too. It's seven sevens. It's the promise of seven. It's the oath associated with seven. So you know, God's pretty clear on that seven is the answer, and that everything revolves around seven. So when you don't celebrate this, and there's not a Christian in the world, nor a religious Jew that celebrates Teruah. I mean, it's the number of people celebrating Teruah would be simply Torah observant covenant members. Mm-hmm. And yet, by ignoring it, you're ignoring all of this emphasis on seven. You don't know God's timeline. It plays out over 7,000 years from the time that man was exiled from the Garden of Eden to the time that the whole earth is returned to the Garden of Eden. You miss it all.
Right. And you know, if you go to Exodus 23, which is Shemoth, or names, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It basically tells you that there's three, I'll paraphrase a little bit, there's three celebrations, three times that you celebrate these seven Mikras.
Right.
The spring and the summer, of course, and the fall, and now that we're into the fall thing. And so it tells you exactly the fall that the Teruah is in the fall. So you even the minimum amount of study, amount of study, and all of a sudden it's right before you face, if you were a Christian, you would have to say, well, what have I missed here? Or what have they failed to tell me? Because you don't have it set in time.
Mm-hmm.
He tells you it's vitally important. It's your own volition to do so. You can choose not to do. You
right.
can ignore it. But he says it's vitally important. You know, he wants you to celebrate with him. Why would you not want to celebrate with Yahweh if you say, I love God, but I don't want to meet with him?
If he's telling you that on the first day of the seventh month of time of renewal is an invitation to be called out and meet, why on earth would anybody in their right mind, knowing that, say, nah, I don't want to, I'm not going to attend. Just because God's invited me to meet with him, why would I want to bother?
Yeah, that's dumbfounding. I mean,
it is dumbfounding. Yeah, he's saying that Teruah is an invitation to be called out and to meet, to be welcomed. That it's a time to read and recite his testimony and to celebrate their relationship, to be invited into his home. That's what he's saying. That's what this day is all about. And you're going to say, as a religious person, no, I don't want to meet with God. Just because God gave me an invitation to meet with him doesn't mean I need to answer it. But why wouldn't you? And does he say this day is Kodesh, set apart?
It's set apart. It's a very special day. Shabbaton. So, yes.
Absolutely. It's important. God has set it apart to make it special. Entering this, we're having a conversation with Kirk over the introduction of Teruah. There is a really interesting term in the midst of Yahweh's presentation of Teruah. Before we just get to what Teruah means, right in the middle is this word Zikaron. It's based upon Zakar. Zakar means to remember, to remind, to memorialize, and it is also associated with a firstborn. So it is memorializing, providing a reminder of an inheritance right to become a son.
Yes.
So. Teruah is about this as a reminder, a memorial sign along the way to participation in the covenant.
Right. An inheritance, right?
Yeah, an inheritance. I mean, it's a very important term, Zakaron. Mm-hmm. And then you get to the word Teruah itself, which speaks of sounding a warning and shouting for joy, making an announcement of a healing pathway. This is all pretty clear if you just look at the words, particularly since the Hebrew word for month is repeated twice, and it means to renew.
So my question becomes to you is,
yes.
if I can read these translations, and then what I did is I went to my 26th translation book that has all the modern Christian Bibles, and then I go through all that, and it basically says the same thing, except they changed the word of Yahweh. You know, it doesn't mean say so in everyone, but if you read all the different translations, you can pick it out. a scholar should be able, a so-called scholar, theologian should be able to pick this out and find these things and say, hey, wait a minute, this is something ongoing. This is something is very important. This is very special. It's not a command, but it is certainly urged. And he says, do this for all times. And you find words like olam, which is forever and ever and ever.
Forever and ever. Right.
And these sort of things. And if I'm so dumb, I can't figure this out with a couple of books because I'm not a very good on the computer. These guys should be able to figure this out. So you have to, there has to be malfeasance, right?
You would, once you do translations where you look at the words and you look at all of the tools, like you have all these books, I have all these books. There isn't a translator or a theologian in the country that doesn't have the same books. And once you recognize how easy it is to correctly convey what Yah was saying by referencing Hebrew-English dictionaries and Hebrew-English interlinears, and just doing a modicum of research on the very interesting nature of Hebrew grammar, which is extraordinarily straightforward and simple, that in doing that, you come immediately to understand what God is saying. And you then recognize that the English translations do not correspond to the definitions of the words themselves. And when you recognize that and how easy it is to demonstrate that, I can't come to any other conclusion than what you came to.
Yeah.
Deliberate malfeasance.
Yeah, I keep trying to give them a break, but I can't give them a break.
It's deliberate. They know what they're doing.
Now, when the Gestalt finally came to you, obviously you walked away, but other people study that are not theologians and teachers. I mean, my gosh, there's a Bible study on everything, it seems like. Why are the numbers so few?
So few people.
You always said there's few, but still, I don't understand why there's so few.
That was one of my first reactions when I came to closely examine and carefully consider his testimony, which is something that he asks us to do regularly. So that should be a very common thing to do. The Torah stands apart from all other books ever written. The prophets are unique in the whole of the human experience. The most profound, the most easily verified, the most copiously copied texts of all of the entirety of the human experience. And the only texts that are credible in their introduction to God, that prove that there is a God and that God talked to us. And so you'd think that there'd be a lot of people who would be interested in what he had to say. And yet there are very few. And then when you spend just a modicum of time searching what he actually said in the words that he said this to us, and you find that they're completely incompatible with your religion and with every religion.
Gestalt.
Yeah. Why are there so many people that then abandon God's testimony so that they can cling to a religion that they know has, at this point, a 0% chance of being true? I mean, that's the question you're asking, isn't it?
Yes, sir.
And it's the overwhelming preponderance of people cling to a religion that cannot be true. Mr. Rule is a date that is a meeting set apart to meet with God on the first day of the seventh month, and that it is also called a Shabbaton, a celebration of the Shabbat. It's important to know that the Hebrew word Shabbat is based on Sheba, meaning seven. The same word, vocalized Shaba, is to swear a binding oath, to make a promise. The third vocalization of the root of Shabbat completes the picture. Shaba means to completely fulfill and totally satisfy. So, Shabbat is a promise, a binding oath, that completely fulfills and totally satisfies in association with seven. God swore a binding oath whereby he promised to perfect us, totally satisfying us by fulfilling his promise, and that those who rest, reflecting and relying upon what he has done will stand with him on the seventh day. To this profound truth, we have a unique ending to Shabbat and Shabbaton. So it's not an ordinary Shabbat. God's not saying that the first day of the seventh month is going to be the seventh day of the week. He's calling it a Shabbaton. And based upon the research I've done, I think the most likely candidate for the basis of the own ending in Shabbat own is Owan. It means to observe with a critical and questioning attitude. Now, from right, this adds to our insights, connecting the covenant's scriptural explanation of our participation in the relationship with Yahweh that leads to salvation with what's found in the eyewitness accounts. Yahusha and his disciples told those who were seeking to understand the path to God that they had to, well, in Greek, translated into Greek, metanoia, shub in Hebrew, change one's attitude and perspective. So we're asked to observe with a critical and questioning attitude. That's one of the things also reinforced, is it not, by Mikra, which this day is a Mikra, which means to read and recite?
Yes, sir.
It also tells you what you ought to be doing on the Shabbat and the Shabbatons.
Right.
And it's not just read and recite in this case, but Mikra is an invitation to meet with God. So it's reading and reciting that which is an association which facilitates meeting with God. I know we're RSVPing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the fulfillment of Teruah, how do you think that ties in with this notion of meeting with God, Kirk?
I'm sorry, how does it?
Yeah, how does the fulfillment, because the Teruah is the first of the seven Mikra, Mikra in the plural, that have yet to be fulfilled. So there's going to be a fulfillment of Teruah. I mean, thus far,
right.
Yahweh has fulfilled Passover, becoming the Passover lamb. He fulfilled Matzah, having his soul go into Sheol to redeem us. He became the firstborn on Bukurim, leading the way for us to follow as born spiritually into the covenant family. And then he fulfilled Shavuah, the promise of seven, when he went back to the Father and the set-apart spirit came upon those who had availed themselves of the first three Mikra. This is the fifth. It is yet to be fulfilled. So it's going to have a fulfillment that somehow has to tie into an inheritance right and to a being invited to meet with God. How would that fulfillment, do you think, tie in with an inheritance right and meeting with God?
Well, I know what the symbol, I mean, what we're memorializing is an event that's going to take place in the future.
Yeah.
And we know, unlike most of the prophecy preachers who can't figure out even what day it's going to be on, we have a rough idea of when we think it will, the year will happen, which is late in the season. But, you know, the day is about when he will come and take us away. He talks about a harvest.
Right.
And the harvest and the harvest of grains, and it's the third harvest in the sequence, and he's going to take us away and protect us. And you just spent 2 hours warning the world of what mankind is doing to itself in the most horrible fashion. I mean, it was pretty graphic today. I want to tell you, it's a couple of times even Terry just kind of walked away, you know, and it's pretty hard to take when you know all this stuff.
Yeah.
And the other side of the
coin. The bombings, the killings, the assassinations, the ravaging by disease, and, you know, not only the Islamic State, but our response to them.
Yeah, we're as bad a ravager as they are. When we get engaged with them, we're worse.
Right.
Because we can kill faster.
Yes.
But the beauty is, this is true, is the antidote for those of us who don't want to live in that world. We're being exposed to it, but it's going to get even worse and worse and worse, as we all know. I mean, eventuality has to be that way.
Yeah. In fact, so the inheritance right is that the covenant children are being taken away.
Right.
And we're going to meet with Yahweh spiritually by being taken away from this earth while the earth just slowly spins out of control into worldwide calamity.
Terry asked a question last night while we were studying this, and she was wondering, in between the post-Bikurim, which was another harvest, through Teruah, which will happen probably around 2026 or 2027, somewhere in that neighborhood, would be the best guess. What on this particular holiday, what was, how many, are there just so little souls that only be thousands? Is that what he's talking about, that he's saving thousands, or won't there be?
Yeah, he quantified the, yeah, he quantified the number. That are actually harvested on this day that, are still alive. Now, personally, I think that, that all of those who have, participated, have engaged in the covenant, prior to, this time and who have passed away are already celebrating, with Yahweh. In heaven and already part of his home. So, I think that he's only speaking of those who are participants in the covenant who are still alive, when this, celebration is fulfilled. And he has told us that the number is going to be approximately 7,000. And of those, 3,000 to 4,000 of them are going to be Goyim. And leaving 2,000 to 3,000 of them to be Israelites. And he uses the term of olives on the tree. So, you know, the olive that is still on the tree is still alive. You know, it's still, so it's has to be gleaned from the tree. So we are those who are going to be still alive, who will be harvested in this marvelous event, a celebration of the covenant family and of Yahweh as our Father doing for us what a loving father must do, which is he's keeping his children out of this horrid time of the tribulation. And the reason he's doing that is the tribulation is unlike any other period, the final 7 years of man's malfeasance on earth, because the restrainer is pulled away. Yahweh is going to go celebrate his relationship with us in heaven. He's going to allow earth to be corrupted by man and Satan. And it's going to get really nasty here, and he doesn't want his children here. If his children's here, he's got to pay attention. He's got to protect his children. He would much rather be celebrating life with his children in his home and not having to witness the terrible carnage that man perpetrates on his fellow man during these 7 years. So that's why he's removing us. And you're right. Well, we know the day that this harvest is going to occur. It's going to occur on Teruah. And there's not a lot of them left prior to the tribulation. I mean, we're 2014. The tribulation begins in the fall of 2026. And you've got, 12 years, right?
Yes.
Not a lot of them left. The only question is that he did not specify which Teruah he was going to remove us. Now, God's pretty consistent in character, and he typically tries to give people the maximum amount of time to figure it out.
Yeah.
You know, for example, the ultimate reconciliation of his relationship with Yisrael and Yehudah doesn't begin on the first day of the tribulation or prior to the tribulation or in the midst of the tribulation. It begins right at the very end of it.
And Noah preached a long time.
Right.
You know, he gave him a lot of warning. He said, this is coming, guys.
Yeah, it's coming. Yeah, God waits to the last possible moment to give people the maximum opportunity. And so the likelihood is that while we are Teruahing, while we are shouting a warning to the religious and the those who are apart from God, those who don't consider the Torah, that there is a path to God and it's highlighted in the Torah. While we're doing that now, there's going to come a time where our voice will be silenced.
Now, you keep saying path, and that triggers something in me. It's like, you know, that we talk about this as a pathway and a path and the followers of the way.
Mm-hmm.
We're going a certain way, and then you have a signpost along the way, a Zion,
mm-hmm.
And an upright pole is the signpost. And
right. And Derek
what
is the path.
What does everybody think the path is if it's not celebrating this? I mean, we're not having to do anything. We're celebrating what he did along this path.
Yeah, how many times do we have Yahweh speak of a and actually engage in leading people on a walking journey?
Yes.
I mean, it's only
Abraham,
one.
Abraham, you got Abraham walking.
Well, Abraham, you know, he told Abraham, I want you to go over here. He didn't lead Abraham there, but he said, you know, I want you to go there. Yeah. But in terms of God actually engaging personally to walk with his people in their presence from one place to another,
well,
it's the Exodus.
Exodus.
Yeah, it's the Exodus. And what's the first day of the Exodus?
Passover.
Yeah, and the second day?
The second day is Matzah.
Yeah, and the third day?
The Bukurim.
Yeah, and when did Yahweh reveal his Torah on Mount Horeb to his children?
That was the...
Seven days later. Yeah, Shavuah.
Yeah, when you enlighten.
Shavuah. Right. Absolutely. And so that's how, and when in 33 CE, in year 4000, did not Yahusha himself walk this same path and in complete observance of the Torah? Didn't he not celebrate Pesach, Matzah, Bukurim, and Shavuah in that order on the right days?
Right. So the question is, why doesn't everybody know this is the path? I mean, what path are they on? What are we looking
for? Yeah, I mean, how many times does he use the term path, the walk, the way? It's Derek in Hebrew. Welcome back to Tabernacles. The reason we're talking about a period of time where we don't know the year that the true harvest is going to occur is that the only prophetic timeline that were provided for the true harvest is provided in Zechariah and by Yahshua, Isaiah and Zechariah. And in those two presentations, we learned that the event that serves to lead up to the tribulation is the Islamic war that is taking place today in Syria. And particularly America's engagement in that war is what God speaks of in Isaiah 17 and 18. And that the aftermath of that war and the terrorist assault of Islam and the belligerence of the United States leads to Israel being thinned at the waist, being narrowed, which means that the West Bank is going to be capitulated now that Gaza has already been capitulated to the Muslims. And that is going to lead to an influx of jihadists by the tens of millions, if not the hundreds of millions, into Israel. But right between the thinning of Israel at the waist and this world war where Islam, after having destroyed Syria, enters Israel, is when this harvest takes place of those who are gleaned from the olive, which is the source of a metaphor for the spirit and is, you know, grounded, rooted, you know, the long living tree rooted in Israel. And so there is a reference in Daniel that speaks of the tribulation being associated with the this covenant between Israel and many this re-edification of a treaty between Israel and surrounding nations. So it's a combination of those things are going to occur. And I suspect that the treaty to thin Israel at the waist is going to happen right around 2026, and that the Magog War would begin in 2027, and that in between these events is when we're harvested. With the tribulation beginning in fall of 2026. And for that, all you have to do is realize that if year 4000 Yahweh was 33 CE, when Yahusha fulfilled the first four Mikra, 40 Yobel later, 2000 years later, it's pretty hard to miss that 2033 is year 6000 Yahweh. So all you have to do is from 2033, which is the year that he's going to return, which is year 6000, subtract 7.
Yeah,
subtract 7, and you're in the fall of 2026. which means that, you know, I think it's 2026. Now, the reason that, there can be some wiggle room here is that, Kirk, one of the things we've learned as you really study Yah's depiction of the last days is that there are two aspects of this tribulation, this time of Jacob's trouble. The first 3 years are bad. The last 3.5 years are just hell on earth.
Yeah.
And so God could allow us to remain during some of the first 3.5 years and still be merciful to us and merciful to those who would hear what we have to say.
Well, he can protect you even in all that stuff. So, I mean, it's not,
right.
It's not like like you should. I'm sure it's going to be bad, but
But everything would indicate to me that I think the most likely time is going to be the fall of 2026, possibly the fall of 2027, and God could remove us this evening. I mean, there's 12 or 13 teruahs that qualify. One of them, I think, the odds are low for tonight, but there is a far less than I think 1%, even though it's 1 out of now 12 or 13 teruahs. I think the odds are not 8%.
The reason I don't think it would... I'm sorry. No, the reason I don't think it'd be 2027 is because you got William and Larry in Florida, and then you got this big crater coming down in the Atlantic Ocean. So you're going to wipe out the West Coast, and surely he's not going to leave them there unless they all move.
Yeah, that's actually in 2029. Yeah, 2029. No, Apophis strikes in the midpoint of the tribulation in 2029. It's Friday, April 13th in 2029 is when Apophis is going to strike. That's also when the volcanic side of the island in the middle of the Canary Islands is going to slide into the sea, creating two tidal waves simultaneously. And so that's the midpoint of the tribulation. Thank you, Kirk. We'll be back tomorrow.